Hi, this is Lex, and welcome to the FinTech Blueprint. It's your podcast about fintech, decentralized finance, digital banking, investing, robo-advice, artificial intelligence, and all the other frontier technology that is transforming financial services. To get more content, like an illustrated transcript of this conversation in your inbox, subscribe at fintechblueprint.com. So without further delay, let's jump into today's episode. Hi, everyone, and welcome to today's episode. I'm really excited to have with us Chris Brookins, who is the co-founder of Rosify, a new multi-chain DeFi primitive for undercollateralized lending. We'll talk about what that means, and we'll talk about fintech lending more generally and the purpose of it and the emerging ecosystem in and around Web3 for this financial instrument. And with that, Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Lex. Really glad to be here.
My pleasure. So let's start off by understanding a little bit how you work and where you've come from. Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of your foundational experiences in lending, in banking, and kind of how you got your start?
So my background, principally as it pertains to ROSI, is, as you alluded to, I'm a reform banker, as I call it, principally working within the corporate debt or commercial loan divisions for some of the larger commercial banks that are based here in the U.S. with PNC and Huntington, to name those two. And then I transitioned out of banking because, much like a lot of people, got captivated around the 2016-2017 area by blockchain, what was happening in the market, and thought to myself that maybe it would be interesting if we could do something within the quant realm, given at that time the market was relatively unsophisticated. So I stood up my own quant crypto hedge fund. It was called Valiendero Digital Assets, recruited a bunch of PhDs out of Carnegie Mellon, where I'm an alumni from as well, and essentially stood up two machine learning trading strategies. They're directional, not market neutral. So Race Capital did that for almost 2 years, and I stood Valiendero down at the beginning of 2021 because my advisors now, but just colleagues at the time, came to me and said, I'm advising for this company. Given your background, maybe it makes sense for you to speak with them about being a pool delegate. That company was Maple Finance. This was before Maple Finance was Maple, so to speak, given they've long since become sort of a bellwether within this particular market, but they hadn't even launched back then. I didn't end up doing the pool delegate situation, which is simply an underwriter for layman's terms. But what it did do is it got me thinking about this particular problem of under-collateralized credit and the lack thereof on the blockchain or within crypto, and how would I go about solving that? And given my background in underwriting loans for business and retail consumers, but then also my most recent experience within machine learning, I knew that it was going to be some sort of mixture of those two. And that's essentially what I started the hypothesis with, that ultimately morphed into what became Rosify. But Rosi is kind of a culmination, an intersection of all my passions, but also my previous work experiences as well.
If you look at your commercial and retail banking days, and we can all be reform bankers, but I think it's a really useful skill set to carry that, and that knowledge, end of the day, gives you perspective. What is commercial banking, and what does it mean to underwrite in that context? Can you walk us through a little bit of just like the mechanics of what that slice of the industry was and how you were participating in it?
It's going to be semi-different on a bank-by-bank basis, but it all rhymes at the end of the day. So commercial is simply a fancy word for business or corporate, but up into a certain amount of annual revenue. So typically, where they bucketed it was commercial was about $200 million in revenue, I believe, and then anything north of that fell into the corporate bucket. But at the end of the day, they are just all businesses. So you are underwriting the creditworthiness of businesses based upon the assets that they have on their balance sheet, and also the liabilities that they have on their balance sheet as well, and also the earnings or free cash flow that would be flowing through that business as well. So a very simple case, just in case like it's too accounting jargony. If LexCorp had $100.
Great name. Thank you for that.
Yes, it's super original. If it had $100 of cash on its particular balance sheet and $20 in debt, maybe it needed to borrow a little bit at the beginning from an investor or a creditor, whatever it may be, your net worth would be $80. So the $80 would be categorized as retained earnings, but ultimately the $100 of assets is something that could be looked at as the ability to service a loan in the event that no cash flows were available to service it. So we always looked at that kind of as a secondary area of coverage for a loan. The principal form of repayment is going to be cash flow. So how much revenue is the business making? And then what are its costs? That flows down to what would be considered income. And then from there, there's all these different types of accounting things, which I definitely will not bore your listeners with. But if there's some things that need to be stripped out, there's some things that need to be added back in based upon accounting terminology. But what you get to is actual free cash or free cash flow that is flowing through the business. And ultimately, that is what is going to service the loan. So if LexCorp took out a loan from RoSeFi for $20 and LexCorp's free cash flow was $5 a year, I know that under best case circumstances that everything stays status quo, which it never does, it is going to take LexCorp 4 years to repay our loan, just the principal, not interest on it, assuming that nothing happens. But I can also look and place a lien on his assets that he has on his balance sheet of $100, just in case that there's a macro hit or maybe his business skids a little bit and his cash flow gets squeezed. I know if something hits the fan, so to speak, that I can always take a lien and, in theory, liquidate those assets to make my loan whole again. So that is probably the most in-depth of talking about underwriting than I've probably done for the past 8 to 10 years. So yeah, hopefully it was as simple as possible for the readers to kind of understand what that is. And it's the same exact thing on a retail side, except for it's going to be a little bit different given the assets might be equity in a home, and then the cash flows are going to be what your salary is minus expenses and any existing debt. So it all rhymes, but the inputs just slightly adjust from a retail consumer to a business.
Well, there's two directions I want to go. One of the directions is to say, what were, generally speaking, these loans for? If I'm some entity that is able to get a line of credit, what is the underwriting for? What is the purpose in terms of using that capital?
So whenever we would write up the analysis or the underwriting proposal that it would go to credit committee, there was always sort of a box that was sources and uses of funds. So where's the source of the funds coming from? But then also, what is the expected use for the debt if it were approved? And it can be a whole range of things, but typically it would go towards financing capital or operating expenses, maybe paying salaries. If it's more of a tech company, maybe financing some innovation, a new product line that they want to push forward and they would rather not pay out of pocket for the first 12 months or so of that innovation, and then let the cash flows from that new product line or tech line or service line pay for the loan over time, also without having to raise equity to finance that as well. Or it could just simply be that they're looking to purchase back some equity from stakeholders or equity holders, do token share buybacks, kind of similar to what you see within the traditional equity market as well. And then in some other times, it becomes a mergers and acquisitions type situation. So maybe they're going to buy out a partner that no longer wants to be in the business, or maybe they're looking to buy out a competitor that they think that they can move forward the industry, whether it's a new product or service or intellectual property as well. And in rare cases, it would be a combination of senior debt, what I'm describing to you, where there's an actual legal lien, legal recourse, so to speak, which we can dive in further on the chat. But also maybe it's a highly levered deal and they need to add in a piece of junior debt that doesn't take a senior lien, but it still falls under that particular category of debt. And it's called mezzanine or subordinated debt. And that typically comes with a higher interest rate because it doesn't have access to that first rights in the event that, you know, crap hits the fan and you need to liquidate assets. The senior is going to get paid back first before the junior.
You know, debt is there for risk. And we're, of course, going to end up talking quite a bit about the crypto and DeFi ecosystem. And the context of that in the last 6 months is the financial liquidation cascade as a number of players get delevered. And I think there are people who sometimes forget that debt is for taking risk, but there are different types of risk. And those can be operating, which is, you know, you've described, we want to have a new product and take the risk of it growing. We want to maybe acquire a competitor and get more market share. And all of that stuff is about like the real economy, the things and the products that are not financial engineering, but are actually the risk of trying to make something in the world and maybe it happens or not, but is of that economic quality. And then there are risks that are financial that have this character of, I want to buy back my equity, or maybe I want to lever up the company and have higher returns or whatever it is. But I do think it's important to just flag that the core purpose of lending is to take on that risk, which actually leads to entrepreneurship and creative activity. So it's kind of my thought there. I wanted to transition us to your experience and kind of skill set around starting to get into the markets and then starting to get into analytics, deep learning, and artificial intelligence. I mean, I imagine you got into that quantitative world quite early on, whether it was with Valor or Pluto AI. Can you talk a little bit about how you encountered machine learning and how did you start thinking about that as a tool within financial instrumentation?
Sure. So quickly, just to take sort of a detour to sort of double click on what you said previously with debt. So I think it was best said by Joseph Schumpeter, like dubbing debt as creative, allowing the creative destruction of entrepreneurship. So essentially what you see where new entrants displant existing incumbents, and debt typically under his model was the fuel that enabled that. So what I always tell people, and one of the core principles that we stood up ROSI with, is I would like to drive the change within blockchain or crypto of debt getting back to more of that core vision where, yes, you are taking on risk, but it is financing innovation to actually drive this ecosystem forward for productive utilizations of debt or capital, so to speak, versus looking simply to finance speculation. But you 100% hit the nail on the head. And because of that, I thought it was at least worthwhile in my mind to kind of take that detour.
If you use the word productive, and I think that's a really good word, and it's also like a technical word, right? It relates to products, it relates to production, to GDP. And I've been spending a lot of time thinking about the future of Web3 as an economy. And certainly that's not an original thought, but I think is the shift that we all have to take.
100%. If we're truly building something, the future of something, whether it is the future of finance, the future of logistics, or the future of whatever, we have to be able to finance productive utilizations of whatever we're trying to either disrupt or disintermediate in some way. And right now, we've created efficiencies that don't exist in the traditional world for being able to essentially call them capital markets. But in our case, talking about being able to take loans, albeit over collateralized, but it's just financing speculation and further kind of exacerbating reflexive feedback loops. Whenever asset prices go up, great, everyone looks like a genius, TVL goes great, but then the reflexive feedback loop goes the opposite way, which we saw most recently with the debt shakeout. But it can, over time, mute that a little bit because it's financing, again, that word, productive utilization of capital or actual innovation that will change people's lives, presumably for the positive, whether that is through a finance setting or a supply chain or whatever setting it may be. But to your original question, what got me into machine learning and AI? So I got my undergraduate degree within finance and economics at the University of Pittsburgh. So I'm a Pittsburgh guy, born and raised. I'm highly biased. But I went, did my banking time again, my reformed bankerness. And essentially, I had a thought to myself to where I did not want to be sort of a, it's a derogatory word, but at that time, I didn't want to be a career finance hack to where we were constantly telling these entrepreneurs how they should be running their business based upon me analyzing and scrutinizing their particular financial statements, whether that's balance sheet, income statement, or cash flow. And I always had the hankering to be an entrepreneur, but I knew that the world was moving more towards a data-driven space, data analytics. So you will. I mean, highly buzzwordy, but that's how I felt. And again, being from Pittsburgh, I knew Carnegie Mellon kind of was the top of that particular list, in my eyes at least. So I went and got my graduate degree from Carnegie Mellon, where I specialized not only in entrepreneurship and a little bit of business elements as well, given it was at the business school of Tepper, but I heavily concentrated within the data analytics side. So statistics, hardcore statistics, but then also machine learning as well. And that is essentially what set me on the path of where I'm at right now. So that's what got me introduced to Valor Water Analytics, which was a analytical startup doing water conservation and other insights based out of California. Same exact way for Pluto AI in a little bit different segment of the water market. And then ultimately leveraging those experiences and that passion for standing up Valley and Darrow Digital Assets, which was a trading shop or a hedge fund predicated upon ML strategies.
In trying to apply machine learning to markets, what are some of the experiences and insights that you've had? You know, and I've gotten different types of feedback from, you know, it's great for something that's very high frequency, that's looking a couple of minutes ahead, but it falls apart on longer term timeframes, to, you know, on any data that is sequential, it's almost impossible to use a machine learning approach. We use machine learning just to generate, you know, hundreds of hypotheses, and then we manually test each one and kill them and figure out what to do next. What was your experience applying machine learning, whether it was to the traditional markets or to the crypto markets?
So what I'll say is, it's difficult no matter what you're looking at. It's going to be difficult because the real world is the real world. It doesn't behave as you would see in some of these use cases or essentially academic settings. Even the smartest, brightest people that I ever came across at Carnegie Mellon, we still struggled to bridge that gap from theory to practice in a lot of ways. So the top of the list is that it is very difficult. But what I would say is it's about finding that sweet spot for your particular methodology that works for you. So if you've got infinite resources, access to high-powered computers and database and all that sort of stuff, and you want to use the most sophisticated AI deep learning algorithms, LSTM, or anything like that, and you have those resources to go after it, then you can still be very successful. It just comes down to where your resources going to be at. If you don't have those sort of infinite resources, then you need to find kind of your sweet spot or your niche within the market. So you don't want to be too long, obviously, but you also don't want to be too short, because then you're essentially knife fighting with the Citadels, the Two Sigmas, and people that are way more capitalized and have an armada of PhDs than yourself. So you need to find that time series duration period that fits for not only your model, but also, you know, is scalable as well. So essentially, the juice is worth the squeeze. For us, it ended up being the hour trading interval that provided the edge, so to speak. We started out with a minute, data, thought about going a little bit more granular. We did day and then 4 hour and so on and so forth. But ultimately what it turned out to be is our niche and competitive advantage for that time period, given markets are constantly changing, was the 1 hour interval. So I would say that markets in general, financial markets, whether it be crypto, equities, what have you, they are by far the most difficult problem to try to fit any type of machine learning or artificial intelligence model or algorithm to, bar none, just simply because the action that people take influences the outcome. So it's highly nonlinear and it's very, very easy to get false positives. On more defined problems that you see within the tech world, so whether that be speech or driverless cars or even credit analysis for that matter, that is far more easy to predict because the data set is a bit less nuanced, so to speak. Anytime you're working with financial markets, it's going to be a very, very difficult problem to tackle. And even with Renaissance, if you talk to any of those people, a lot of it is very, not simple, but a lot more simple methodologies for profitability than you ever would have suspected, just because a lot of times the super fancy, sexy stuff, it doesn't work in practice. Looks great in a PhD paper that's been published and this, that, and the other. But whenever you actually try to implement it in the real world, it doesn't work.
Let's transition to Rosie and to thinking about lending within the DeFi context. I think a lot of people are familiar with, you know, the broad strokes of what it is to get credit in decentralized finance, which is, you know, there's some box, you put some assets in that box. In return for that, you get some type of stablecoin or other asset that is worth less than the things that you've put in the box. Then if the markets go up, everything's fine. You continue to have the stablecoin that you can use most likely to lever up or just to use for spending. And if the markets go down, your collateral is worth less. And then you either have to top up your collateral or you let the protocol seize the collateral and then you're left with the cash. And so this is a little vending machine. I mean, it's actually not little, it's quite large, and it's several dozens of billions of dollars in these types of protocols, whether we're talking about, you know, Maker or other kind of leverage machines within Aave or Compound. But this is a very popular financial primitive that the DeFi world has used for leverage, for taking directional positions, and so on. But in a moment of market crisis, it's become clear that a lot of the leverage was for financial purpose, not for productive purpose. And to have credit be used for productive purpose, you often have to lend it to participants that aren't coming with lots of capital already, that don't have, you know, quote unquote, equity to put in to a box and then draw against, but rather need capital to start and, you know, pursue things from scratch. So that's a very broad strokes characterization of lending in DeFi. I'd love to hear your view on, you know, kind of whether that's right or wrong, and then what opportunity that you saw with Rosie, maybe with Maple, and how you think about the under or not collateralized lending space.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect sort of summation of it. So to elaborate further, the reason why the structure exists how it does is for very good reasons, because in blockchain or crypto, we don't get a chance to see who's on the opposite end of that particular loan contract. So if I'm Aave or Compound, I don't get to see that this is Lex on the opposite end. He's obviously has a paycheck, a good job. He is more than likely to repay this loan. I just see 0x in a string of characters. So in order to guard myself and guard the protocol solvency from, or guard the protocol from insolvency, the first step to doing that has been over-collateralization. So just like you said, give me $150 of collateral and I'll give you a $100 loan. And I think that is a very, very good first step to bootstrap lending within this space. I won't call it credit because it's not actually credit. It's more akin to a pawn shop. But I think the market has realized, not only from a capital inefficiency perspective, but also that is not actually credit. And to your point, that's not actually how the real world works. So I would venture to guess greater than 95% of all debt or credit that is issued in the world is under collateralized. And it's done so typically to finance productive use cases, especially if we're talking from a business perspective. Retail, it tends to get a bit more dicey, which is a little bit of a different topic. But I agree that one of the interesting pieces about it is, if everyone was super flush with capital, why would they necessarily need an under-collateralized loan? Maybe, again, there's capital efficiencies to be had from that, or they're really looking to lever up their position, whether that is directional in one way or the other, but it doesn't service the greater good, whether that is crossing the chasm to the next 1 billion, 2 billion DeFi users around the globe, or even real world entities that could benefit from the efficiencies that blockchain capital markets present versus needing to go to the traditional financial markets and do the underwriting and investment banking fees and all these sorts of other elements as well. We're not tapping in, as it stands now in this current version of DeFi, to those particular use cases, which, you know, people like myself and other protocols as well are looking to sort of spearhead that initiative moving forward.
Let's dive in on how ROSI works, or at least how do you think about the right way to underwrite? And if you could talk us through sort of the algorithms, the data sets, and the approaches that you've thought through and taken to try and get your hands around risk in this space, that would be a great start.
So I think it's very important. You mentioned a key word there, risk. And that is essentially what you do whenever you're issuing credit. You're underwriting the risk. And as I always tell people, defaults aren't necessarily a dirty word. You know, from our particular instance, that's our target variable for ML jargon, as to what we're actually trying to key in on, to see what characteristics of a borrower on chain only, not necessarily looking at who they are in the real world or any of their off-chain data sources, what particular characteristics or data elements are indicative of repayment or are indicative of defaults. So it's all about risk. And I think this most recent flush that we saw within CeFi, but then also DeFi kind of exacerbating the forced liquidations, is essentially there was no risk management at all in any of these particular elements. So as I've said previously, I kind of look at risk in three particular buckets, at least from our DeFi 2.0 perspective. So the first is creditworthiness, and that is straightforward. So does the borrower have the ability to repay your loan? Again, going back to that initial example that we had, talking about LexCorp at the beginning of the podcast. And then the second piece is trustworthiness. So is the borrower willing to repay your loan, which is kind of where that intersection comes in with the pseudo-anonymity nature of blockchain lending protocols, which we can talk about more in depth as well. And then the third piece is reputation on chain in Web3, so to speak, not necessarily off chain, so that the borrower has something to lose in the event of defaulting, that it's not just an anonymous string of 0x dot dot dot. Maybe we don't know who they are in the real world, but we know who they are in Web3, and that is possibly tied to an ENS or to an NFT collection or to another piece of information that allows us to assess reputation, so that in the event of default, they have something to lose, thus kind of that carrot for good behavior as well. That can go too far which is what you saw within CeFi in this most recent flush. They essentially just said reputation is everything, and that's all that matters. Three Arrows, Celsius, and probably a whole gaggle of other ones. They've got billions of dollars on their balance sheet, and they've got a stellar reputation. Smartest guys in the room. They'll never, even if they take massive losses, they'll always make good on their loans because they've got a great reputation. They want to guard it. And furthermore, we have legal recourse. We have their KYC, so we can go after them in the real world. Slam dunk. We don't need to do any credit analysis or any risk analysis. That's not the case. And unfortunately, that had to be found out the hard way from DeFi and greater blockchain and crypto markets with sort of having this purge. But unfortunately, I'm seeing it get permeated within the space of DeFi as well, most with the most poignant example being Vitalik in his Soulbound token post and saying that this is something that can be utilized for reputation-based lending. And I agree with Soulbound token. I think that is a great aspect. And we've actually set up our own NFT long before Vitalik ever mentioned, had a mention of Soulbound for that very reason. But reputation only will not take you the entire way. That's why you need to look at risk from separate buckets. And that is how we view it within ROSI and the data that we've gone through and some of the pivots looking at the data helped us do that. And a more poignant example, jumping back up to trustworthiness, is fraud analytics. So previously, whenever we started, the hypothesis was we can make credit decisions based on on-chain data only, how they interact with DeFi protocols, DEXs, you name it. Typically, it is within regards to some financial capacity. If you have never taken out a loan or interacted with any DeFi protocol before, and you want to come to ROSI to take out an under-collateralized loan, that's a big red flag for us because you've never shown any propensity for that type of behavior previously, but all of a sudden you kind of want to cut the line and jump straight to the master's courses of an under-collateralized loan. So there needs to be some aspect there, but we thought that would take us the entire way. And through our trials and tribulations, we realized, okay, there's too much risk there. We need to layer in fraud detection, meaning looking at the existing databases that are out there to build up our own model that we can proactively target fraudulent addresses to throw them in our own fraud database so that we can easily cross-reference those when someone comes to our platform and looks to take out a loan. Furthermore, we have the capabilities of a fraud score to essentially judge the probability that this address or batch of addresses is in fact fraudulent, whether it be hacking, phishing, you know, the whole gaggle of bad behavior, but just hasn't been tagged as such previously. So one being the lowest risk and 10 being the highest risk. And then the final iteration, again, going back to reputation, is trying to layer in this Web3 social credential stuff, which has gotten really popular, but I don't think anyone really knows what the heck they're doing with it. They're just all kind of shooting in the dark and hoping something will stick. The fact that ROSI is vertically integrated, meaning we're not just doing on-chain scoring with normalizations from other protocol data, which a lot other credit scoring protocols or services, so to speak, are looking to do. We're actually issuing the loans ourselves and taking losses if there are defaults in the pools, along with our lenders as well, and using that to retrain the model, and as well as figuring out what pieces of Web3 reputation, quote unquote, are actually useful in being able to predict and understand repayment or default rates versus just kind of shooting blindly in the dark.
The two things that stuck out at me are, you know, this idea of being able to leverage the open data set. I think that's a really important idea. And then second, and I mean analogous, but still distinct, is the idea of reputation and community and tribes. And I want to take each one instead and kind of feedback a little bit of what I understand and then maybe double click on some of the stuff. So in the first instance, where you are trying to create an underwriting model and you're saying, look, we don't want defaults, right? So let's create an algorithm that ends up, you know, prejudicing people that walk away and rewarding people or addresses that don't walk away and pay back the loan. And whereas in the banking world, you can do that if you're a large bank and you are sitting on top of lots of your own data, and then through your operations over several years, because it needs to be statistically significant, et cetera, you're able to generate one of these models, and they should be getting tighter over time as you go through different credit cycles and so on. As a startup in fintech, this is unbelievably painful to do because you rarely get access to information, to data at scale. No bank wants to give some fintech all of their customer data. And I think this is one of the reasons why artificial intelligence startups have generally struggled to do anything meaningful in finance, because they don't have the core fuel to put into their thing, whereas Google and Facebook, you know, and JP Morgan do. But in the blockchain world, all of that data is free and open. So you can see what is going on in all the lending protocols. You can see those addresses entirely, and you can try to understand their behavior and build models that use that to learn underwriting decisions for the future. Is that characterization correct? Can you talk a little bit more about like what kind of data you're pulling from the chain and from what kinds of protocols, and like how does the sort of meat and potatoes of the deep learning stuff actually work?
So that characterization is 100% correct. And it's one of the, it's the core hypothesis or proposition that ROSI was founded upon. So there's not a big depth from a time series perspective of data on the blockchain, given it's only been in existence for a handful of years, but the breadth is actually quite massive, and it's only getting more gargantuan as the seconds and days tick by. And you can only imagine the repository of insights and information that will be there over the next 5 years. So we realize that very quickly that, yes, we are solving probably the hardest problem in the room from a DeFi perspective, the hardest way. In some other protocols are taking a bit more easier path, and they're receiving a lot of traction because of it. But again, it's about being able to cross that chasm. And whenever we are able to prove out the concept and roll it out to the masses, that's whenever you sort of see that hockey stick style growth, because we went straight at the jugular of the hard problem to begin with, albeit it doesn't look nearly as sexy at the beginning, but there needs to be a risk managed approach. So to your other question, some of the particulars on the data that we look at. So we look at everything, like I mentioned before, all protocols across a variety of chains. Principally, we look at Ethereum being, you know, the heaviest hitter, Avalanche, Binance Chain, BNB Chain. We look at Polygon, obviously, we're deployed on Polygon, and we're looking to expand over coverage to some other EVM compatible chains as well. That's really the only constraint for us at the moment, is it has to be an EVM compatible chain, given that is where the most rich data set is from a historical perspective of behavior. But over time, we'll look to expand out to other non-EVM chains as well, obviously with Solana being a notable one, given the voluminous data that is growing there by the day as well. So looking at a variety of DeFi protocols on all those chains, it doesn't matter what it is. We just try to flush it through the classification model that we have to be able to see whether or not it's remotely significant to being able to predict defaults for borrowers from a historical basis. And some things that we've seen, some DeFi protocols are very informative, meaning lending protocols are informative. Some DEXs are very informative as well, but some are not, unfortunately. So one example I would say is Cream was another one that was not overly informative for the model's accuracy, but that constantly changes as you update with new data. So given we are targeting lending and repayment behaviors, the model will take a heavier weighting towards addresses that have interacted with other lending protocols within the ecosystem, taken out loans previously, and repaid loans previously as well. But over time, that will be kind of supplanted with our own platform's data, that eventually becomes the heavy lifting or the gasoline that will ultimately drive, I would say, 90% or 95% of the decisions as well. Because again, as we look at other protocols, there's a normalization that needs to be taken into consideration, because under collateralized lending, as we're doing it, DeFi native does not exist. It exists now because we've done it and we launched about, what, a month ago? But previously, it did not exist. So there's a normalization that needs to be handled there. But because we're vertically integrated and issue our own loans, it allows us the freedom to learn and iterate a lot more quickly. But yes, those are typically some of the variables that we look at.
There's some weird things that emerge out of these dynamics, which is kind of like the, you know, what happened in China with some of the visualizations of the social credit system. Like, and this goes a little bit to your point about reputation and NFTs as a persistent reputation mechanism. The machine learning model has no heart. It only reflects back the truth, right? So there could be, and this is me just entirely speculating, but there could be, you know, the model could come back and say anyone that's used SushiSwap is likely to default and everyone that's used Uniswap is likely to pay back their loan. Or anyone who holds a CryptoPunk is more likely to pay back their loan and anyone who holds the Solana NFTs is likely to default on their loan, right? Or something like that. You end up creating this data set, which is like this behavior police. If you go into these neighborhoods and you walk down these streets and you use these ATMs and you go to these art galleries, you're like a bad person. And if you go instead to these well-lit streets that are the most popular and kind of like the most used, then you're a good citizen. I wonder how true that is. And I wonder whether you've seen those types of dynamics and if you have any concern about that.
At a high level, we've seen some of those dynamics play out in the insight from the models that we've seen thus far. But again, it's constantly moving. The market's dynamic and so is the data. But yes, we have seen some of that. That is also another reason why we've chosen not to open source the actual mechanics behind the model at the current moment, because we're essentially showcasing a blueprint to the world, A, for bad actors to exploit the protocol, but then also to drive some of these behaviors that you're speaking of, which might be endemic of protocols and behaviors now, but maybe that's for reasons that we don't understand. Again, the ML model doesn't care about the logic or unintended consequences or what is actually driving some of these dynamics. It deals in cold hard facts. So by not open sourcing it right now, we remove some of these bad or kind of red line elements of what we used to call back in banking, to where bankers used to literally red line neighborhoods that they were not allowed to make loans in, typically within minority neighborhoods. So we don't want to definitely, we do not want that to be ROSI's legacy, which is why we've kind of taken this approach at the beginning. And ultimately, our goal is to, again, retrain the model with ROSI data doing majority of the heavy lifting, given we are literally the only ones collecting this information, because we have chosen to actually go in the arena to put not only the protocol's reputation, but then also our own capital on the line to get to the heart of these problems. But over time, gradually have ROSI's algorithm and the NFCS, our non-fungible credit score, which is the NFT that actually maps to your credit score, as kind of an intelligence piece that people, that lenders can reference whenever they're depositing into ROSIFI lending pools. So rather than it being the dominant driver, it is simply just another piece of intelligence that they can query from and ultimately make their own decisions upon whether they believe that or they don't believe it. And we're working on some other added on elements that will enable that as well. Because I think the market or the industry has shown a preference for free choice. And that is what we're driving towards. But also by doing that, it removes potentially some of these bad unintended outcomes as well.
Fascinating discussion. There's so many different directions we could continue to go on. I think it's very clearly one of the main building blocks for having productive economies sprout out of these blockchain networks and for getting out of the financial engineering trap and towards economic growth. With that, I'd love to ask you if our audience wants to learn more, whether it's about you or about ROSI, where should they go?
So if you want to learn more about ROSI, go to our site, roci.fi. There is tons of information on the side icon where our blog, we've got tons of information about more modeling details, how lenders earn their APY within our lending pool, so on and so forth. And then there's also links to our GitHub page as well, and then link to our Twitter account as well. It's a fairly unique name, so it should be quite easy to find. And then, I'm constantly trying to spread the good word or the good gospel about ROSI as well on Twitter. So please follow. It's at Crypto Brookins, Brookins, no space. And yeah, there's tons of information there to be had, both myself, but then also for ROSI as well.
Chris, thanks so much for hopping on and having this conversation with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Lex. I really enjoyed it.
Hi, everyone. That's it for this week's episode of the FinTech Blueprint. For more technical deep dives into all things fintech and decentralized finance, check out fintechblueprint.com and grab a free subscription to the newsletter. This is Lex, and I'll see you next time.